Thank you, God, he thought very quietly and sincerely. And the butterflies beating about so fiercely in his middle stilled their wings. I don't know what I did to deserve this, but thank you. Voices roared on every hand as he and Iris crossed Cathedral Square down the cleared lane between the lines of hand-picked members of the Royal Coruscantian Army, the rifles coming up to port arms in formal salute as he and Iris passed were polished, but he had no doubt they were loaded, and those glittering bayonets had a far more serious purpose than mere ceremony. He saw eyes watching the crowd alertly, and mounted cavalry sat their horses, elevated enough to see far out over the cheering Coruscantians who packed the square. There were no Carizian troops present today. This day belonged to Coruscant and to Princess Iris Dakin. And if he wasn't supposed to look at her, he could at least glance at the intense, focused expressions of the men charged to keep the two of them safe on the endless walk to the cathedral where Clermont Geerling and Michael Stainer awaited them. They were very reassuring, those expressions, especially with so many thousands of voices battering them with thunder. Corin Garvey breathed a huge sigh of relief as his princess and the duke made it safely to the cathedral. If it had been up to him, they would have made the trip in a closed coach with three other coaches in the same procession as decoys. He didn't care if it was scarcely 200 yards from the palace to the cathedral. For that matter, if it had been left up to him, he would have sent their coach to Carus to be plated with the same armor they'd put on those ironclads of theirs. And then he would have posted a dozen riflemen on top of all four of the friggin' coaches. And after that... Oh, stop it. He shook his head. Next thing you'll want is 12-pounders on both sides of the square. Iris was pissed off enough when you hinted that it might be a good idea to use one carriage. She'd have ripped your head off and shoved it up a handy bodily orifice if you'd even suggested using four of them. No doubt she would have, yet over the last few 5 days he'd found himself deeply in sympathy with Sergeant Merlin and Sergeant Seahamper. And unless he could escape to the Imperial Army, he was going to be stuck with overseeing their security, and Diven's, indefinitely. On the one hand, he loved his cousins and would never begrudge any duty to them. On the other, he really wasn't cut out for this sort of thing. Far better to put Charles Doyle in charge of it. Well, Charles and Earl Corus. If anyone could keep them safe, that was the pair for it. And if finding the very best qualified people and putting them in charge just happened to let Sir Corin Garvey sneak off to the army, well... He snorted and maintained his position. He truly regretted missing the ceremony, but his father was there to represent them both, and his time was best spent out here, keeping an eye on things. The airy cathedral was a blaze of tropical sunlight through stained glass, its jeweled colored beams striking down through a drifting canopy of incense, while the choir's voices rose in hymns of celebration. Hector and Iris walked slowly, steadily down the central aisle into that music and chiaroscuro of colored light, flanked by heaps of cut flowers and packed pews. Even here, guardsmen and soldiers in immaculate uniforms stood watch along the cathedral's walls. They would have been there for Iris under any circumstances, Hector thought, but in another time and another world, their tension level probably would have been far lower. And they certainly wouldn't have been worried about him. It had taken time for that truth to sink home. He was no longer merely a junior naval officer who happened to have added the name Armok to his own. He was no longer even a duke who was also a serving officer, expected to take his chances in the crown service like any other officer. He was still both of those things, but in another hour, he would also be a husband, married to the Prince of Coruscant's sister, and those guards, those watchful, intent soldiers, dedicated to keeping him alive, were about to become an inescapable part of his life. It was something Iris had always had to put up with, but it wasn't something about which Hector Applin had ever worried his head, and a part of him longed to return to who he'd been before the Battle of Darko Sound, wanted desperately to run away from the responsibilities and burdens of who he'd become instead. A sense not of panic, but of dread flowed through him like a minor descant, a thread of darkness weaving itself into the day's blazing joy, and somehow making it even more precious. Everything in life carried its own price, he thought, and anyone who was unwilling to pay that price was unworthy of those who loved him. Michael Stainer stood in the sanctuary beside Claremont Gehrling and watched the absurdly young couple walk gravely towards them. Young Hector had become another son to him long ago, and Iris had become a beloved daughter during her time as his guest in Tellisburg. No one would ever guess looking at them that they felt the least uncertainty, the tiniest trace of anxiety, he thought. Hector would never be a handsome man, and he still had quite a bit of filling out to do. Yet today, in his lieutenant's dress uniform, his sword at his side, he looked every inch the man, not the boy, who'd saved the lives of Diven and Iris Dakin. Few people had ever grown up as hard and as quickly as Hector Applin Armagh, and fewer still had paid the price he had to do it. But God had builded well in that young man. And beside him, as if she'd been born to stand at his side, Iris Dakin, with her hazel eyes, dark hair, strong chin, and composed, almost serene expression. Not yet quite 20, and she'd seen so much, paid a price every bit as hard as Hector's. His king had died in his arms, killed by the navy her father had launched at the kingdom of Karis's throat. Her father and brother had been cut down by assassins in the streets of their own capital, and she'd known beyond any shadow of a doubt that Caleb and Charlian Armagh had ordered that assassination. She'd sworn her life to vengeance upon them, and today she was marrying their adopted son. Not because anyone had required her to, but because she wanted to. Because she'd had the strength and courage to look beyond what she'd known to see the truth she hadn't known. It would have been far easier for her to cling to the hatred, close her eyes to that truth, yet instead she'd found the bravery to trust the promise of her father's mortal enemies to protect her baby brother and prince, and in the process, she'd made their cause her own. As the two of them reached the sanctuary, he remembered another wedding 4 years and 7,000 miles away from this one. Caleb and Charlian hadn't been that much older than Iris and Hector, and theirs too had been a marriage of state, yet they'd found the strength and surety they'd needed in one another. So would Iris and Hector, he thought. So would Iris and Hector. They stopped at the flower-decked rail, and he smiled upon them. One of the greatest joys of his priesthood were all the sons and daughters it had added to his life, and he'd been prouder of none of them than the two who stood before him this day with their hands clasped, their heads high, and their eyes bright. But this was not his church, and this was not a Carisian wedding. So he simply bowed ever so slightly to both of them and stood at Gerling's shoulder to assist.
My children, the Archbishop of Coruscant's voice rolled clearly through the cathedral. This is a great and joyous day. These two young people have come before you and before God and the archangels to be joined in holy matrimony. It is the marriage of two people who, I may tell you of my own personal knowledge, love and respect one another deeply. It is the marriage of two hearts who wish to become one, to stand together in the face of all of life's tempests and temptations, sorrows and joys. And it is also the marriage of Coruscant and Karis, not because it was forced upon them, not because of calculation or ambition, but because in these two people's love for one another, and in their determination to stand for the light against all the works of darkness, even in the face of hell itself, we see ourselves and our future. Join them now, as they reach out to the light from whence all of us came, and to which, in the fullness of time, every true child of God must return. Celebrate with them, share their joy, witness their promise to one another, and pledge yourselves to that same great and glorious cause. Open your heart, experience their love, and let all of us prove ourselves as fearless as they, willing, eager, as God's true children, to follow where they lead.
It was very still, almost hushed throughout the enormous cathedral, and then Gerling smiled broadly and raised his hands.
"And now, dearly beloved," he said, "we have gathered together here in the sight of God and the archangels, and in the face of this company, to join together this man and this woman in holy matrimony, which is an honorable estate, instituted of God and the archangels, signifying unto us the mystical union that is between God and his church, which is a holy estate which the archangel Langhorn adorned and beautified with his presence in his time here upon Safehold, and is commended of the archangel Bedard to be honorable among all men. And therefore it is not by any to be entered into unadvisedly or lightly, but reverently, discreetly, advisedly, soberly, and in the fear of God. Into this holy estate these two persons present come now to be joined. If any man can show just cause why they may not lawfully be joined together, let him now speak, or else hereafter forever hold his peace."
Iris Aplin Armagh wondered if her smile was going to split her face as she floated from Monsieur Cathedral on the wings of the organ's wedding march. She clung to Hector's arm far more tightly and possessively than she'd allowed herself to do on the way into the cathedral. That was probably a breach of protocol, but he was hers now, all hers, and this was their wedding day. All those political calculations, all those details of procedure and protocol and court etiquette could take themselves somewhere else. She'd worry about them again after the honeymoon. She giggled. Positively she giggled at the thought, stretching inside like a cat lizard, reaching for the joy she'd known was lost forever in those dreary years in Delphirach. The sunlight beaming down was no more brilliant, no more warming than the sunlight filling every nook and cranny of her heart. Her brother was safe, confirmed in his crown, and she, after so many storms and so much despair, had come into the safe harbor of the young man she'd discovered so unexpectedly that she loved. She had absolutely no warning. But suddenly Hector had his arms wrapped around her, twisting her off her feet, throwing her toward the ground. She stiffened, shock whiplashing through her, and there was a crack of thunder like the end of the world, a brilliant flash half screened by Hector's body, a sound like a thousand hissing serpents, another sound like a baseball bat hitting a catcher's mitt, and his sudden convulsive gasp. There were the beginnings of screams, the sudden realization of terror, and then his weight was coming down upon her, horribly and horrifyingly limp. Something hot and wet sprayed across her wedding gown, and her head struck the cathedral step, and her own frantic cry of denial spiraled into the darkness with her.
Chapter 21. Royal Palace, City of Monsieur, Princedom of Coruscant. It's my fault. It's all my damn fault, Corin Garvai grated. I knew something was wrong. I knew it. And I still...
No, it isn't your fault, his father said flatly.
Earl Anvil Rock's eyes were dark, his face haggard, as he looked at his son, but there was no doubt in his voice.
We took every precaution we could think of, short of actually clearing the square, and Iris and Philip were right. This wedding was a crucial component of our transition into the Empire. If we'd let it appear that we were frightened of how our own people would react to it, it would have been disastrous. And this wasn't.
The black stitches closing the long, deep gash in Garvai's right cheek stood out plainly in the lamplight, and he carried his left arm in a sling.
Langhorn, Father, we've got over 200 dead and twice that many injured, in addition to Hector and Iris.
I know.
Anvil Rock's expression was bitter.
But we never thought they'd be so stupid. Even the damned Rakurai should have known better than to attack Iris.
His father was right, Garvai knew, not that it made him feel one bit better. It had been an act of madness to attack Iris directly, especially on this of all days. Whatever the temple's supporters might think, the fury it must generate among those who loved her and her brother would be incalculable. They'd known that, and expected the Rakurai to be smart enough to realize the same thing. And so even though they'd conscientiously tried to include such threats in their calculations, they'd never really believed it would happen. They'd been wrong. It wasn't like the mammoth explosions with which the Rakurai had first announced their existence. He supposed they should all be grateful for that much, although it was hard to be grateful for anything at the moment. They had no witnesses, no surviving witnesses, who'd seen exactly what had happened, but evidence suggested it had been the work of a lone fanatic. How he'd gotten his explosives into position remained a mystery, but at least they knew where he'd been. Somewhere in the first few rows of the space which had been roped off for those who required assistance to get about, or were unable to stand for lengthy periods. People grown frail with age, no longer able to care for themselves properly, he thought bitterly. People, young or old, with spine fever, who'd had limbs amputated or permanently crippled by accident or disease. People who'd already suffered more than enough without Sir Corin Garvai allowing someone to end their lives in one moment of transcendent horror. The semicircle of carnage around the assassin's location had been incredible. Bodies had been ripped apart, as if by a charge of canister or grape shot, and that was precisely what had happened. Whoever the murderous bastard had been, he'd clearly known what he was doing, and he'd managed somehow to get the equivalent of one of the Carizian's sweepers past all of Garvai's precautions and watchers. The explosion had sent scores, probably hundreds, of old-fashioned half-inch musket balls scything outward in a fan directed at the wedding procession. 62 of the known dead had been Garvai's soldiers and guardsmen. Their bodies had absorbed much of the blast and fury, but over 100 of the civilians gathered outside the cathedral had either been killed outright by the explosion or trampled to death in the panic which followed.
Whoever planned this knew exactly what he was doing,
Anvil Rock said after a long, brooding moment.
He got his frigging bomb into exactly the right position and detonated it at exactly the right moment.
Why not on the way in?
Garvai asked. His father looked at him, and he shrugged.
It probably doesn't matter, but why did he wait? As you say, he obviously knew what he was doing, so why wait? Every minute he sat there was a minute one of my men, or even I, God help us, might have spotted him, realized something was out of true. So why not kill them as soon as possible rather than risk the delay?
I don't know. How should any of us know what was going through his head?
Anvil Rock stumped to the window and looked out at the thousands of votive candles burning all across the enormous square in the windless night.
Maybe he was waiting until they were married, so he'd be able to claim Iris was a Carisian. Maybe that was part of his message. Or maybe he wasn't in position yet when they walked into the cathedral.
He was, Garvey said flatly. His father turned his head, arching one eyebrow at him, and he grimaced.
No one was admitted to that section without a written reservation, issued by the Archbishop's guard after certification that it was needed, and checked against the master list by two separate people, and no one was allowed to enter or leave it starting an hour before Hector and Iris left the palace.
He shook his head.
No, he was there, and somehow he got past all of us. We let him do this, Father. We didn't let anyone do anything, Corin.
Anvil Rock sounded decidedly testier.
We struck the best balance we could between security and the need to allow public access, and—
The door opened abruptly, and a grim-faced Charles Doyle came through it. Father and son turned to face him, and he raised the envelope in his right hand.
This was delivered to the palace 10 minutes ago, he said. I've got the messenger in custody, but I don't think he had any idea what was inside it. In fact, I think he's telling the truth when he says he doesn't even know who he was delivering it for.
I assume it has something to do with the attack,
Garvey said, and Doyle nodded.
In that case, what makes you so sure he wasn't part of it from the beginning?
Because he's a Baedardist monk from the Monastery of St. Christopher, and he was told the message, addressed to you, by the way, my lord,
Doyle said, glancing at the Earl,
was from Father Simon.
What?
Anvil Rock's eyes widened in confusion, then narrowed in sudden speculation.
Simon Hallock? Why him?
According to the monk, and I'll send a semaphore message to his abbot as soon as it's daylight to confirm all this, the letter was handed to the monastery's hosteler by a Langhornite underpriest who guested at St. Christopher's on his way to Lyon on Archbishop Clermont's business. When he stopped, he discovered he'd inadvertently brought the letter with him, and his business in Lyon was too urgent for him to lose 3 days returning to Monmouthshire to deliver it in person. So he asked the abbot to have it delivered to you for him. Our monk was selected to do the delivering, and I guess he got to Monmouthshire at least a day earlier than our Langhornite expected, given all the traffic clogging the roads with the wedding coming up. If he'd been just an hour quicker, he'd have gotten to the palace before the wedding party left. As it was, and after the explosion in the square, it took him hours to find someone willing to admit him to deliver it.
The man who'd become the Regency Council's chief of intelligence shook his head.
I don't think he had a thing to do with it, my lord, and I do think whoever used him for this wanted to point a finger in Father Simon's direction.
And what's in the damned letter?
Anvil Rock demanded.
See for yourself, my lord.
Doyle held out the letter. Anvil Rock took it with the air of a man reaching for a venomous serpent and unfolded it slowly, then tilted it to allow his son to read over his shoulder. To the everlastingly damned and accursed heretics, blasphemers, and demon worshippers who have rebelled against God's will, murdered his priests, joined themselves to Shanwei's cause, entered into the dark with all their hearts, and made themselves the enemies of all God's faithful sons and daughters. Know that you have shown your true colors as the betrayers of Coruscant and all her people, as well as God, the Archangels, and Mother Church. If you will embrace the harlot of Karis and the servants of Shanwei, if you will sell all of Coruscant into Carisian bondage, you make yourselves the enemy of every true child of God and lover of Coruscantian freedom. You think yourselves safe, protected by the bayonets of the soldiers who slavishly serve you in defiance of the Grand Vicar's writ of excommunication. You believe not even God can reach you, and in your corruption and arrogance, you raise your hands against him whose archangels gave life to this entire world. You set your will against his. You seek to deliver all the people of this realm of Coruscant into the chains of hell, and in the dark recesses of your hearts you exult in the power you pervert in Shan Wei's name. But God can reach you through the hands of his servants, and we have taught you so this day. Be warned, this is but the first of the blows Langhorn's Rakurai have in store for any who renounce their true allegiance and duty to God and give themselves to the dark instead. Treason, blasphemy, heresy, and apostasy can be expunged only by blood, and expunged they assuredly will be. There was no signature, and Garvai's eyes narrowed. Assuming there was an ounce of honesty in the person who'd written it, the letter confirmed that this had been the work of Clinton's Rakurai. Of course, it might equally well be intended as disinformation. He was rather at a loss to think of anyone else who might have been behind the attack, yet they'd had proof enough in Khorasan that secular opponents to the Regency Council could seize upon religious pretexts to cover their own ambitions. Then there was the supposed author of the letter. Simon Halleck was Archbishop Clermont's senior and most trusted aide. No one who'd ever met Father Simon would believe for a moment that he might have been involved in something like this. Unfortunately, the number of people who'd met him was minute compared to the number of people who hadn't met him. The fact that he was a native Khorasandian might lend a certain credibility to the theory that his patriotism had been so outraged by the decision to join the Carizian Empire as to drive him into open rebellion, and the fact that the letter had been left at St. Christopher's by someone claiming to be a Langhornite could lend additional credence for those inclined to believe the worst, given that Halleck was himself a Langhornite underpriest. And, of course, Archbishop Clermont's aide would have been well placed to provide the assassin with the written reservation needed to get into position for the attack. There was no way in the world Halleck had done anything of the sort, but the Rakurai had nothing to lose trying to drive a wedge between him and Archbishop Clermont. "Well," he said finally, taking the letter from his father and skimming it once again, "I'm not particularly inclined to take a mass murderer's word for the sanctity of his motives, and I'm certainly not prepared to accept that Father Simon, of all people, would have been party to something like this."
"Neither am I,"
Anvil Rock snorted harshly.
"Ambitious bastards, aren't they? Not content with implicating Father Simon, they're ready to take a shot at Terrell, too."
Garvai looked up from the letter, frowning. Then his expression cleared.
"I missed that one somehow, Father. You're right, though."
The supposed Langhornites' announced destination of Leon was the third largest town in the earldom of Tartarian. Given how he directed their attention there, he'd almost certainly gone somewhere else entirely. But it would certainly be to Clinton's advantage if his killers could drive a wedge between Anvil Rock and Earl Tartarian, his closest friend and most trusted political ally. And what they might not be able to convince Anvil Rock of, they might hope to convince Prince Divin of. He was only a boy, and it wasn't unreasonable to assume that his grief and his hunger for vengeance upon his sister's murderers might cause him to turn upon those accused of complicity in her death.
"I wonder where else copies of this will turn up," Garvai mused aloud after a moment. "Just sending it to the palace seems a bit under-ambitious." "A good point," his father acknowledged.
"A very good point, in fact," Doyle agreed. "Remember Sajan Merlin's letter right after the Grey Lizard Square attack? He said Clinton sent out his killers solo, with specific orders not to build any sort of local network we might penetrate. If this was the work of the Rakurai, and they're operating true to form, there won't be anyone to tack up broadsheets or stand on street corners haranguing people. So if we do see copies of this letter on walls throughout the princedom, we'll know we're dealing with something else. Frankly, I hope we are. A bigger network could do more damage, but it would also give us, and the Sajans, a better chance of penetrating them."
"I'd like that, Charles,"
Corin Garvai said very quietly, turning back to the window and the candle flames burning in vigil as the grieving people of Khorasan prayed for their princess. I'd like that a lot. Iris Aplin Armok sat beside her husband's bed. The right side of her face was one massive bruise. The dull ache of a broken cheekbone marched throbbingly through her, and her vision was curiously unclear, wavering like something seen through heat shimmer and illuminated with waves of color which had nothing to do with lamplight. At another time, she might have noticed that pain, worried about that lack of clarity. Tonight, she did neither. She simply sat, holding Hector's right hand in hers, listening to the harsh, wet sound of his breathing, and her eyes were dry. She was past the tears now, at least for the moment, and there was a great, aching emptiness at the core of her. Hector had saved her life. There was no question about that, but the cost of her salvation came too dear. He'd shielded her with his own body, and in protecting her, he'd been hit 3 times himself, in the left arm, in the back of his right thigh, and on his right shoulder blade. The leg wound was the least severe, a deep, ugly trough ripped through the big muscle on the back of his thigh, as if by some huge talon. He'd lost far too much blood from it, but the arm was worse. Under other circumstances, the Pasqualates would almost certainly have amputated just below the elbow, and even if by some miracle the arm had been saved, it would have been severely impaired, even crippled, for life. But that wasn't going to be an issue, she told herself drearily, because the bullet which had hit his shoulder had passed completely through his body, ripping its way through his right lung, missing his heart by fractions of an inch, and doing God only knew how much other damage on its way through. The senior Pasqualate had faced her with the stern compassion and honesty of his order when she'd demanded the truth. Hector, her husband, was dying. No surgeon's skill, no apothecary's knowledge could change that. In truth, the Pasqualates had no idea why or how he had survived this long.
I'm sorry, love.
The thought floated with a fragile, harrowed serenity over the empty ice of the future which had seemed so bright this morning.
I'm so sorry. I should have known what that monster in Zion would do when you saved Divan and me from his butchers. I should have realized he'd move heaven and earth to correct his failure, and I should have stayed as far away as possible from you. My father, my brother, and now you. Everyone I let myself love, he marks for death. But he missed me.
She laid a slender hand on Hector's forehead.
He missed me, and someday, somehow, somewhere, my love, I will rip out his black heart with my bare hands. And the only thing I'll ask, the only thing I will go to God on my knees for, is that he knows who's killing him.
Iris. She looked up.
Michael Stainer stood beside her chair, still wearing his vestments, splashed with Hector's blood, although he'd insisted that she change out of her blood-soaked wedding gown. Stainer had been among the first to reach them, the one who'd applied pressure to the sucking chest wound, gotten tourniquets around the wounded leg and arm, while Iris was still unconscious. Without him, Hector would have died long before the Pasqualates got to him, and he'd refused to leave Hector's side, or hers, since.
He's still alive, Your Eminence,
she said quietly, smoothing the dark, curly hair.
Still alive for now.
Stainer's eyes were gentle and compassionate, without the stark despair she knew must look back at him from her own. It was the nature of his vocation, she supposed, She recognized his own grief for Hector, his own anger. Yet for him, there was still a future. There would always be a future for him, even beyond the dark wall of death, one formed and revealed to his inner eye by the depth of his faith, and she knew even now how important that shield of his faith would be to her in the days to come. Yet just now, at this moment, it was more than she could share, and she felt one of the tears she'd been certain she'd exhausted hours ago trickle slowly down her cheek. The Archbishop's gentle finger wiped it away, and then he put his arm around her in wordless comfort.
"You should go, Your Eminence," she said, leaning her head against his support. "There must be hundreds of other people who need your comfort and care, and you've already spent hours with me. Hector doesn't know you're here, and I already know how much you love both of us. You've given me that, and I'm not so selfish as to keep you when others need the same gift from you, and there's nothing more you can do anyway."
"You're wrong, my dear," Stainer said softly, hugging her more tightly. "There is something I can do, and I can't leave until I've done it."
Iris's throat tightened, and she wanted to deny what he'd just said. Hector had already received the last rites. The only thing Stainer could do for them now was to be here to share the moment when her husband took his last breath and her heart shattered forever. She knew how much she would need that comfort, and yet if she sent him away, perhaps the moment would never come. If he wasn't here, if he couldn't comfort her, perhaps Hector wouldn't die after all. It was irrational, and she knew it, yet she opened her mouth to argue anyway, only to pause as Stainer straightened suddenly and turned his head towards the glass doors to the bedchamber's balcony. There was something about his expression, a sudden flicker of something that might almost have been joy blended with worry, and then he turned back to her. He captured the hand which wasn't holding Hector's between both of his own large, powerful palms and looked deep into her eyes.
"My daughter," he said softly, "I'm about to ask you to do something you shouldn't have to do, something you may not be able to do. But I know the strength of you, and I know the love within you, and so I ask it of you anyway."
"Your Eminence?"
She felt the weight of his words even through her exhausted despair, and she was suddenly afraid. Afraid in a new and different way, as if she stood on a precipice above a deep gorge filled with a howling tempest. It was absurd, and she had no idea what that gorge might be or why the wind shrieked so as it hurtled through it, yet it seemed so clear, so real.
"A moment, my dear."
He gave her hand one last squeeze, then crossed to the diamond-paned doors. He reached for the latch and looked over his shoulder at her.
"You've been through enough for a dozen princesses already today, my child," he said quietly. "I would prefer not to put you through still more, but I have no choice. I ask you to trust me and to believe me when I say that what I see and what's about to happen is the direct and personal finger of God reaching into this mortal world."
"You're frightening me, Your Eminence," she said,
hazel eyes looking deep into the serene faith of his darker, gentler gaze, and he smiled.
"I don't intend to, because there's nothing here to fear. Yet there is ample cause for wonder. Be open to it, my daughter."
His fingers found the latch, and her grip tightened around Hector's cold, limp hand as he turned it. And then her nostrils flared, her eyes opening in shock and disbelief, as a very familiar, sapphire-eyed man in the blackened breastplate and uniform of the Carisian Imperial Guard stepped into the bedchamber from the fourth-story balcony.
I came as quickly as I could, Your Highness.
Merlin Athrawas said softly.
Chapter 22 Nemu's Cave, The Mountains of Light, The Temple Lands.
She took that better than I expected, really, Caleb Armok said soberly. A lot better.
I hate having put her in that position, Charlian Armok said from her cabin aboard HMS Southern Star, midway between Chisholm and Coruscant. I know what it's like when something like this comes at you cold.
Something like this, her husband repeated. Charlie, right at the top of my head, I can't think of anything else remotely like this.
I don't know about that, Caleb.
Narman Bates's tone was thoughtful.
We could always try telling her that there's the ghost of this overweight little prince who haunts a computer buried 40,000 feet underneath Mount Olympus in the middle of the Temple Lands. That might come pretty close.
I noticed none of us considered talking to the Brethren before we acted. Michael Stainair put in from Monchir, and Merlin barked a laugh.
Given that you're the one who put out the call for me in the first place, I think this time around we'll just let you do the explaining, Your Eminence.
Oh, nonsense,
Stainair replied in a tone that verged on the smug.
You have more experience and seniority than anyone else, Merlin. I'm sure they'll take it much more calmly from you.
Sure they will.
Merlin shook his head and leaned back in the comfortable chair in the cave under the Mountains of Light. There had been only two good things about the last nightmare day. The first was that he'd long ago injected Hector and Iris, and Diven and Earl Corus for that matter, with the same nanotech with which he'd injected every member of the Inner Circle. And the second was that Major Athrawas had already been dispatched by Emperor Caleb on another unspecified mission. His actual mission had been to drop in on Duke Eastchair as Abraham Jevons, but that had been aborted the instant Owl reported the attack in Monchir, and his recon skimmer had gone hurtling towards Coruscant at far too many times the speed of sound. Each time he made one of those insane rushes, he risked attracting the attention of the bombardment system's sensors, which was why he'd returned to Nemu's cave at a far more leisurely pace. There had really been no pressing need to return to the cave at all, but he'd needed a place to which he could retreat, a place where he could be with friends, one where he could lower his barriers while they tried to deal with the day's earthquake events and their consequences, and a place, he admitted to himself, where he felt secure. I named it Nemu's Cave for a reason, and not just because I decided to become someone named Merlin. It's always been my place of power, my sanctum, where my familiar and all that arcane knowledge reside, and just this moment, I need to be here, in the middle of who Nemu was and what brought me to Safehold in the first place. He closed his eyes, recalling the desperate race to Monchir, remembering his dread of how Iris would react to his appearance. He'd developed a deep respect and a deeper affection for Hector Dakin's daughter, but no one had prepared her for the truth about him, about Safehold, about the Archangels, or about Nemu Alban's true mission. They'd thought they had plenty of time, 10 years of it, to do that preparing and decide whether or not to tell her those terrible, consuming, impossible-to-believe truths. But fate, or perhaps Michael's finger of God, had forced his hand much as it had been forced by Charlian's attempted assassination. And so he'd raced to save Hector's life, dreading all the way that he would be too late, and even more, what he might be forced to do instead if Iris proved unready to accept who and what he truly was when he stepped into the bedchamber with the medical kit. This time he hadn't had to make the decision entirely on his own. Oh, it had been his decision, and he would have made it in exactly the same way, even if every other member of the Inner Circle had opposed it. There was no other decision he could have made, any more than he could have permitted a trio of krakens to devour a boatload of children on a long-ago day on Helen Island.
But neither Caleb, nor Charlian, nor Narman, nor Michael had hesitated. He was perfectly well aware of the part their love for Hector and their deep affection for Iris had played in that. Yet there'd been other reasons, hard-headed, pragmatic reasons as well. For Hector's death at the Rakurai's hands on the very day of his wedding could have had cataclysmic consequences. The reaction in Old Karras scarcely bore thinking on, given the young Duke of Darkus's place in the hearts of its people. He himself remained largely unaware of it, yet they remembered all too clearly how Hector Aplin and King Harald had fought back to back, alone against twice 100 enemies on the quarterdeck of Harald's flagship. They remembered how their king had died in his arms, and that king's final words to an 11-year-old midshipman had become part of their national heritage. And they'd seen that midshipman grow into an officer of whom their king would have been proud and been enthralled by his rescue of the enemy prince and princess they'd taken to their hearts. The polarizing reaction in Coruscant could have been even more disastrous, especially if neither Iris nor Divan could be told the truth. Those who opposed Coruscant's union with Karras might well have taken heart, found a rallying point to do more than simply resent that union. And the effect on Iris and Divan, both of whom had come to love him deeply, would have been impossible to predict. The odds were that it would have driven them to oppose the group of four even more bitterly. But at what cost? Would it have poisoned them with hatred? And how could they ever have been told the truth later, and known Hector might have been saved after all, if only the inner circle had been willing to trust them with that truth then? And finally, there'd been the chill, pragmatic calculus of empire. It was true that Charlian had stipulated that Iris must wed Hector because she'd known they loved one another, yet that hadn't been her only reason, as both Hector and Iris had realized. That sign of the union of the House of Dakin with the House of Armagh was of untold value on a planet which still thought as much or more in terms of dynasties as in terms of nationhood. For Coruscant and Karras alike, that marriage was the proof they stood together in the teeth of Mother Church's jihad, and they simply could not afford to lose it. "But we almost did anyway," he thought somberly. "If I hadn't pumped everybody's base nanotech after I lost Harald, we would have lost him. Even with it, it was a damn near thing. Of course, that leaves us a few problems of its own." "I wish we could get him back here to the medical unit," he said out loud. "He's going to be 5 days recovering from this in Monchir, and I doubt he's going to have much use of his left hand afterward anyway." "We all wish that, Merlin," Caleb said quietly. "But how the hell do we explain his recovering from those wounds in no more than a day or two? And what happens when one of the palace servants or Pasquales come to check on him, and he's off in the Mountains of Light being miraculously cured? Not even Michael and Iris together could have kept someone from discovering he'd disappeared down a rabbit hole, and then we'd all be royally screwed." "I know that. For that matter," Merlin's lips twitched in an unwilling smile, "Iris knows it. In fact, she explained it to me at some length when I mentioned the cave. It's going to be hard enough for the Safeholdian medical establishment to accept how quickly he recovers if we leave him in Monchir."
"The problem won't be how quickly he recovers," Stainer said dryly. "It's going to be the fact that he survived to recover."
"You're probably right about that," Merlin acknowledged, and shook his head. "I always knew upgrading you all to mil-spec nannies could complicate things if you got hurt, but this... Speaking as someone else they kept alive long enough for you to get there, I think it was a very good idea," Narman put in. "I'm sure you do, but however right Michael may be, there are going to be questions about his recovery."
"Nonsense, Merlin."
Charlian's smile was almost impish.
"Iris will just keep him in bed and nurse him herself, without sharing him with a bunch of healers who might notice things they shouldn't. And no, I don't think she'd want us to deliberately extend his convalescence just so she could play doctor." But do any of you think word won't leak about how Princess Iris is personally nursing her husband back to health? For that matter, you know as well as I do that public opinion's going to decide it was her care and love that kept him alive when every healer despaired and everyone knew he was dying.
Exactly, Narmon agreed. That's just how the story will play out in Coruscant. And with just a little encouragement, we can probably see to it that it plays out the same way in Chisholm, Emerald, Old Caris, and Taro, too.
That's dreadfully calculating of you, my son, Stainer observed. Not that I think you're wrong, of course.
Several people chuckled, as much in a release of tension as in amusement, and Merlin smiled. Trust Charlie and Narmon to put their fingers on the political advantages to be wrung from the situation. For that matter, he was pretty sure Iris was thinking along exactly the same lines by now. She'd actually accepted the truth more rapidly than Charlian had after the attack on St. Agatha's. Part of that had probably been due to her desperate hope that Hector might be saved after all. Charlian had been dealing with the astonishment of her own survival after the fact, not of the man she loved before he'd been saved. Then there'd been Michael Stainer's presence to vouch for Merlin's non-demonic origins. And, Merlin suspected, the same heart hunger which had drawn her to the Royal College had quickened at the revelation of just how big and magnificent the universe truly was. He hadn't had time to prepare comms for her and Hector, but Owl was busy putting together their communicators, among other things. He was sure they'd get the hang of them quickly with Stainer right there in Monchir to tutor them, and he'd promised to personally deliver them, if somewhat more sedately, before he returned to Siddhar City. And I'll deliver their anti-ballistic undies at the same time. His smile faded at the thought. If they'd had them before the damned bomb, neither of them would have been hurt in the first place. At least now I can get them into the same sort of protection as the rest of the Circle. And with Iris and Hector on board, we'll be able to do the same thing for Diven, too. Have we figured out how they pulled it off? He asked, opening his eyes, and Narmon's image shrugged. I doubt we'll ever have all the details, but Owl and I have been over the Snark's imagery. We're pretty sure we know how the attack was executed, even if we don't have a clue how the assassin got herself to Coruscant originally.
Herself? Stainer repeated sharply.
Yes, Your Eminence, Owl repeated. We have no imagery of the device's actual detonation, but we do have imagery from before and after the attack, and I believe Prince Narmon's analysis of what happened is correct.
And that analysis is what, Narmon? Caleb asked, frowning intently.
We examined the imagery of the reserved section as closely as possible, Narmon said. It was crowded and rather hectic, but we were able to isolate at least some images of almost everyone in it. There was one person, an older man in a wheelchair, who attracted my attention because I couldn't understand why he was there.
To see the wedding, I would have assumed, Charlian said.
And I wouldn't have disagreed, except for the fact that he wasn't paying any attention to it at all. He just sat there in the wheelchair. In fact, I judge he was in the final stages of the Grey Mists.
Merlin's lips tightened at the fresh reminder of everything Langhorne had cost the people of Safehold. The Grey Mists was the Safeholdian term for what had once been known as Alzheimer's disease, which old Terra had conquered more than 300 years before humanity ever met the Gababa.
His head was down, and he displayed the classic joint contractures, and he seemed totally disconnected from his surroundings, even when the cheers were loudest, Narmon continued. So the more I looked at him, the more I wondered why he was there. I thought at first that he might have been brought by a son or daughter who wanted to include him in one last family outing, but he was escorted by an attendant, a woman, in the uniform of a squalid lay sister. It was still possible he had family elsewhere in the crowd, but it seemed more likely that if they'd known they were going to be separated, his family would have left him in peace at home. So I asked Owl to take a closer look at him.
He paused, and Owl responded smoothly to the conversational cue he wouldn't even have recognized a year earlier.
I did as His Highness requested, the AI said, and determined that the individual's wheelchair was not of a standard design. Instead of the open framework usually employed in order to keep the weight low, this wheelchair's back and seat were boxed in. It was impossible to determine exactly how the covering was contrived or out of what material, but the enclosed volume measured approximately 5.5 cubic feet. If it were packed solely with gunpowder, that volume could contain a charge of over 300 pounds. Analysis of the damage pattern suggests the explosion was, indeed, centered upon the wheelchair in question. From the explosion's evident power, a substantial portion of the volume must have been used to shape and aim the directional blast rather than filled to capacity with powder. I estimate that there were some 1,500 musket balls in the device, which would have come to approximately 40 pounds of lead, propelled by an equal weight of gunpowder. Merlin winced. 10 pounds of gunpowder were sufficient to throw a 30-pound round shot 3,000 yards. Hector and Iris had been less than 30 yards from a charge 4 times that large. Assuming my analysis is accurate, Owl continued, it is remarkable there were so few fatalities. I attribute the relatively low death toll to the directional nature of the device and the close spacing of the guardsmen and soldiers lining that portion of the route. Their bodies absorbed much of the blast, which is undoubtedly why so few of them survived. The relatively low placement of the charge, resulting from the need to conceal it within the wheelchair, also contributed to the reduced death toll. A chill ran through Merlin's Molly-Cirque nerves as the AI laid out his and Narman's analysis. Owl had developed a much more acute sense of empathy in the course of his interactions with Narman, and Merlin suddenly realized how little his dispassionate tone had to do with lack of imagination. He looked up at the screen displaying Owl's avatar and saw the awareness in those sapphire eyes so much like his own. Saw the intelligence, which had never been flesh and blood, seeking to distance itself from the horror of Cathedral Square. The application for the reserved area is obviously false, since the hospice it supposedly came from isn't missing any lay sisters or patients, Narman said into the silence which had fallen. We've been attempting to backtrack both of them, but we haven't had much luck. Unless someone reports him missing, we'll never know who was in that wheelchair or where he came from. As for the lay sister, hair colour, complexion, and facial features all suggest a mainlander from one of the more northern realms, which would be consistent with Clinton's methodology. She was sent in from outside Coruscant, never made contact with any native temple loyalists, never discussed her mission with anyone, and in the process managed to avoid our Snark's notice just as effectively as she avoided Doyle's and Garvey's. Dear God, Caleb murmured. He sat very still, then inhaled deeply and shook himself. How in God's name are we supposed to stop people like that? People who cross thousands of miles of ocean simply to kill as many people as possible in God's name. People we can't even see coming because they don't talk to anyone at all, about their missions. Unless we want to ask Iva to try and put one of her people inside the Inquisition in Zion, we can't, Merlin replied. Owl and I have developed a new search subroutine for the Snarks watching the temple lands outside Zion, Narman offered. We're trying to improve and refine the satellite imagery of Zion itself as well. Hopefully, we'll achieve sufficiently detailed resolution from the orbital sensors to recognize individual faces of people entering or leaving the temple, and especially the Inquisition's offices. We believe we may be able to identify at least some of Clinton's potential agents, and we intend to run facial recognition on everyone present at any major public event anywhere in the Empire from now on. Owl needs to generate a secondary AI to manage the sheer data flow, but if we happen to identify someone whose image we collected in the Temple Lands, standing outside Talisburg Cathedral, for example, we can hopefully steer security forces towards him. That may help a lot, Charlian said. In the meantime, though, I'm worried by the fact that Clinton used a woman for this. She grimaced. It's just that Clinton's such a confirmed lecher, I'm surprised the idea occurred to him. She grimaced again, with far more distaste. As far as he's concerned, women exist for only one purpose, and it isn't to use their brains or fight as God's warriors.
That's probably true in his case. Merlin's grimace was oddly like Charlian's, with more than an echo of Nimue Alban. Unfortunately, I suspect Archbishop Willem's a bit more broad-minded in that respect. And do any of us think a woman can't be just as committed as any man? The fact that the safehold mindset tends to pigeonhole women as female, no threat, would probably work in their favor when it comes to penetrating our defenses, too. But if they are starting to send out female Rakurai, I'll lay you odds Reyno's the one who came up with the idea. And just how do we explain to all our own dear chauvinistic guardsmen that a mere woman could pose a significant threat? Caleb asked. Send them the imagery of Charlian at St. Agatha's, Merlin suggested with a grim chuckle. Or let them spend a half hour or so in Iva's company. Or, for that matter, I can think of at least 100 women from places like Glacierheart and Shiloh who'd cut a Temple Loyalist's throat without even blinking. All true, and none of it likely to make a lot of difference in their thinking, I'm afraid, Caleb said. My own suggestion would be to use our Seijin network in Coruscant to hand our analysis, cleaned up to exclude any little things like reconnaissance remotes, to General Garvai and Colonel Doyle, Norman put in. We can even circulate a sketch of the lay sister to his men. One of them might have seen her, and even if no one did, it ought to at least get the idea there are female Rakurai out there through their skulls.
And Corin needs that information, Charlian pointed out in a softer tone. Given transit times, they must have sent their assassin out well before Iris and Divan got home. That means she probably came up with this mission for herself, based on whatever orders they gave her before they sent her. I may be wrong about that. There's still that Langhornite at St. Christopher's. He has to be somewhere. But Corin needs to know how she did it, in case she wasn't the only one they taught to make these damn things. And from a personal perspective, finding out how they got through, that it wasn't his fault he never saw a bitch cold-blooded enough to stick a bomb under someone caught in the grey mists coming, might help him stop blaming himself for all those dead civilians.
It might, Merlin agreed. In the meantime, though, we have a problem. I think you're right about when she was sent out, but Clinton's sure to concentrate his efforts on breaking Coruscant back away from Karras. We may well be looking at additional attacks like this one, or some other totally different effort to get through to Iris, or Divan, or Hector, or to Corus, Anvil Rock, Tartarian, or Gerling. Hell, there's dozens of potential high-value targets, and we don't have anyone permanently in Coruscant who can do anything about it. I know we've essentially drafted Iris and Hector, and they'll have access to the comm network and Owl and the Snarks, but they won't be able to do much with it. They haven't built up a support structure they can trust with mysteriously obtained information, and neither of them has the capacity to intervene personally if they pick up on another attack like this one.
That's true, Narman said slowly, and Merlin's eyes flicked to the prince.
I know that tone, Narman, he said. Why am I hearing it?
Well, it happens that Owl and I conducted a few virtual experiments on things besides Olivia's VR suit.
What sort of experiments? Merlin's eyes narrowed, and Norman shrugged.
Some time ago, you asked Owl about building additional peakers, but he told you he lacked the necessary plans and technical data, and there was an uncomfortably high probability of rendering you inoperable if he analyzed your chassis to obtain the needed information. However, it occurred to me that while he might not have the specifications for peaker building, he had a great deal of data on advanced materials, fusion engineering, molecular circuitry, etc. So I suggested he might conduct his own research, using that data, to figure out how your gizzards worked.
Norman smiled brightly.
As I understand it, he spent the equivalent of somewhere around a man-century in virtual R&D.
You mean you could build peakers, Owl? Merlin asked very carefully. No, Owl replied in his most meticulously accurate tone. I can build one additional Pika, Lieutenant Commander Albon. My supply of several critical materials, which my industrial module is currently unable to replenish, is insufficient to build more than one. The silence over the comnet was profound. How long would it take? Merlin asked after a moment. The processes are complex, but none are especially time-consuming, the AI said calmly. The time requirement would be approximately 6 local days, plus or minus 3 hours, from the moment I enabled the nanites. That would help. Help a lot, Caleb said after another long moment of silence. There is, however, one minor problem, Narman said.
What sort of problem? Charlian asked.
We can build the Pika. We can't build the personality to put inside it.
Why not?
Caleb demanded.
Why can't we just upload Merlin to it? It'd let him really be in two places at once. Because his high-speed data port is disabled. The data transfer rate's too slow. It would take a couple of months to make a backup of him.
Forgive me, Narman, but I was under the impression Owl had supplied Merlin with the headset he used to record your personality for the purpose of recording his own, Stainair said.
Not one of Merlin's better ideas, Narman said, with a sly, very Narman-like smile. From his perspective, that is. It worked out quite well from mine.
Why not? Caleb repeated.
Because I overlooked the minor fact that it was designed to interact with either an organic human's implants or a Pika's high-speed data port, Merlin sighed. At the moment, I don't have either, and neither do any of the rest of you, he shrugged. It could still do the job in my case, but Narman's right about how long it would take. I haven't been able to find a big enough uninterrupted chunk of time to record myself, and we don't have the time for me to go on sabbatical and take care of it now either. Especially not if the idea is to put a second Pika into Coruscant soon enough to keep Hector and Iris alive.
Then what about uploading Narman?
Charlian cocked her head as she looked at the little Emeraldian's comm image.
You're already recorded, and you're obviously capable of interfacing with Owl at a very high rate of speed.
The thought occurred to me, Narman said slowly. In fact, I might as well admit that one reason I had Owl looking into the matter in the first place was the possibility of giving me back a body. Unfortunately, I'm not complete.
Complete? Stainair repeated very gently into the fresh, ringing silence.
Oh, I'm entirely functional, Michael. Don't imagine I'm in any trouble.
Narman's cheery tone seemed genuine, and he smiled.
The problem is that a lot of me had to be reconstructed, and there's quite a bit of Owl's DNA in my gestalt. That's one reason he acquired a true sense of self-awareness so quickly after I arrived. Some of his subroutines spend a lot of time directly interfacing with that gestalt of mine, propping me up, for want of a better term, and I'd cease to function if I were separated from him. It was a bit humbling to discover I've acquired a sort of mirror twin, but there's no data exchange unless we deliberately initiate it, so my sense of privacy isn't routinely violated. However, the chance that I, or any of the rest of you who wanted to volunteer for the job, would be able to sustain a functioning personality in a Pika's brain is vanishingly small. In fact, Owl puts it at less than 0.5%.
I suppose that qualifies as small, Caleb agreed. But in that case, there's not much point in building another Pika, is there? If Merlin can't record his personality or upload it directly into another Pika, and none of us could survive in one, we wouldn't have anyone to drive it.
That's not entirely accurate, Narman said very slowly.
All of them looked at his image once more, and he sighed.
As it happens, there is one personality available to us. One, I'm completely certain, would function within the environment of a Pika.
Do you have any idea how lucky you are that you no longer have a neck to wring?
Charlene inquired.
You just finished explaining why none of us can do the job. So where does this personality who could do it come from?
Well, Narman looked at Merlin. It turns out that when Dr. Proctor started modifying your Pika and its software to override the 10-day automatic personality erasure, he wasn't certain he'd be able to pull it off. And he was afraid he'd trigger one of the security protocols and dump your memory when he started probing the lockouts. So, just to be safe, he made a backup of your personality. It's still here, stored in Owl's data core. Merlin heard himself inhale, the sound sharp and clear in the sudden stillness. That stillness lingered for several seconds. Then,
Owl, why didn't you mention this to me when I asked for the unit to record myself?
He asked.
You did not inquire about existing personalities,
Owl said reasonably,
and I was not then as capable as I am now of extrapolating unspoken desires from specific queries. Nor was I aware I possessed this recording until Prince Narman broached the question of virtual R&D. At that time, I conducted a search of all databases and discovered Dr. Proctor's folder. It proved highly valuable, but until I opened it, I was unaware of the data he had stored there.
Merlin nodded. Of course it hadn't occurred to the pre-Narman Owl to expand his search parameters beyond those specified in the original query.
It would be possible, even without your high-speed data port, to record your experiences and memories of events here on Safehold in no more than 5 or 6 days.
Narman appeared to be picking his words with extraordinary care, Merlin noticed.
That would allow us to update the stored personality with all your own experiences on Safehold.
No, Merlin said very softly.
But Merlin,
Caleb began.
No,
he repeated more firmly.
I don't want to duplicate myself in another Pika, Caleb. It's already hard enough for me to remember how much the person I'm talking to at any given moment knows about me. If we build a second Pika, and I'm not certain it's a great idea just yet, it'll be another permanent person, someone who has to interact with other people, the same other people, for months on end. There'd be too much chance of bleed over, of the new Sajin giving away the fact that it has Sajin Merlin's memories.
Caleb nodded very slowly, but Charlian's eyes narrowed, and she looked at Merlin speculatively. She knows, Merlin thought. Of course she does. And so does Narman. The very way he phrased the suggestion proves that. He closed his eyes, his thoughts spiraling inward, and his nostrils flared as he faced it squarely. Nimmu Alban, the Nimmu Alban sleeping in Owl's database, was unstained. She hadn't done any of the things Merlin Athrawus had done. She wouldn't even remember, as Merlin hadn't when he'd awakened as Nimmu Alban in this very cave, having volunteered for the mission before her. And because of that, she bore none of the responsibility, none of the guilt, for all the millions of human beings who died, or were yet to die, in the religious war Merlin Athrawus had brought about. He had no right to burden her with that guilt, those memories. But did he have the right to bring her into the consequences of his actions? To confront her with this world of bloodshed, fury, and hatred? He felt the friends waiting around him, the strength of their support and love, and he knew there were people and causes of enormous worth here on Safehold, but they were so wrapped in pain, so trapped in the ugliness he'd done so much to birth. He drew another of those deep breaths a Pika's lungs never truly needed, and opened his eyes once more.
I'll have to think about it, he said quietly.
Narman, you and Owl go ahead and build the Pika.
I'm pretty sure I'll decide in the end that we really don't have any choice but to put it online when it's finished. But I need time to come to grips with the idea and decide how much, if any, additional memories to include in the process. Chapter 23. The Delthak Works, Barony of Hyrok, Kingdom of Old Chorus, and Thesmar Bay, and Braneth Canal Crossing, the Southmarch Lands, Republic of Siddermark.
My God, what a racket! Excuse me? What was that? Can't hear you, Pater,
Edward Hausman replied with a huge grin, and Pater Wilson shook a fist at him. Of course, he had a point, Hausman acknowledged. His manufactory's work floors had always been noisy places, but it was even worse now. And in many ways, Wilson had only himself to blame. The assembly line they'd just finished inspecting was the product of his suggestion, and the noise level of the pneumatic and hydraulic machinery was the next best thing to deafening. That was why both of them wore the ear protection and safety helmets Hausman had issued to his entire workforce. It was also a very well-lit work floor, considering the fact that this was the night shift. The coal gas tapped from the Delthak Works coking ovens had been piped into all Hausman's buildings, and the overhead gas lamps' polished reflectors poured down illumination. More lamps lit the roadway and canals between the Delthak Works and Ithmin's Lake and ran down the Delthak River to Larrick, and the gasworks he was building to provide the Telesburg waterfront and city streets with similar lighting was more than two-thirds completed. Quite a few people had expressed concern over the possibly demonic aspects of the new lighting, and Hausman had taken pains to warn everyone about the potential dangers of gas. He'd made it clear, with Wilson's support and the Royal College's enthusiastic endorsement, that there was nothing the least demonic about it. Hopefully, describing those dangers would encourage people to take the proper precautions and help diffuse fresh allegations of demonic involvement when the inevitable gas explosion finally occurred. Now he beckoned for Wilson to follow him, and the two of them made their way up a flight of steps to the manufactory supervisor's office. They passed through the office's outer door, crossed a narrow lobby, and closed the inner door behind them. The noise level dropped drastically. It was still there in the background, but the supervisor's office had thick walls and double windows, their panes spaced, like the office doors, to provide sound baffles. The assistant supervisor started to rise to greet them, but Hausman waved her back into her chair with a smile.
Stay where you are, Mistress Simpson. Father Pater's far too suspicious of all we do here for you to waste any courtesy on him.
The brown-haired, brown-eyed woman smiled at them both. Any number of people would have been horrified by Hausman's flippant attitude, but Margaret Simpson wasn't one of them. Although she was no older than Pater Wilson, she was one of the first half-dozen women Hausman had handpicked to groom for management positions in his vast, expanding empire, and she'd been understudying Alec Christopherson for 6 months now. Christopherson was very, very good at his job, or he wouldn't have been the night supervisor for the first Safeholdian manufactory ever to be equipped with a genuine assembly line. In fact, he'd been instrumental in working out the kinks in the process, and Simpson had made several valuable contributions of her own to the process. That didn't surprise Edward Hausman, who hadn't chosen her or any of her fellow women because they were dummies. Fair or not, they needed to be several cuts above the average if they were going to hold their own in their new positions. Even with his full-blooded support, they were going to find it difficult to win acceptance from a great many, indeed probably the majority, of the men who eventually found themselves working for them.